The organizers for inviting me so into this very well-rounded conference. Just to give you some background, I'm part of the theory team at IBM. So I have been a theorist for most part of my academic life, but over the past 2 to 3 years, I've actually worked quite a bit together with experimentalists and in an attempt to take their suffering and plight somewhat seriously. And In doing so, what we've tried to do is we've tried to look at so what are the experiments you could currently do, and is there any value in them as they are right now or as they will be when growing up? So Stefan earlier introduced the term NISQ, and that's very important to actually, in my opinion, to actually point that out, that this is very different essentially from the regular attempt, from what is the majority opinion of what a quantum computer should look like, to distinguish between those two. Because so while probably the majority opinion is that yes, you will probably need error correction to do anything really large scale and meaningful, and yes, to run any fancy algorithms, there's probably not going to be a way around this. However, at the same time, essentially, it would be a shame to not explore or seriously explore what could be done in the meantime. Right? So that's sort of very important to do, I think. And so those were some efforts, basically, that we had with experimentalists and in trying to do that. And the goal here is to come up with very simple algorithms. Okay, they have to be so simple that, in a sense, you have some chance of dealing with the errors that will inevitably occur in your computation to some extent. And but on the other hand, they shouldn't be so simple that they become trivial as to you not needing a quantum computer to do anything there. Okay, and so that's what I'm going to be talking about. So for a large part, I'll actually talk about how you could deal with errors in such an experiment if you're not allowed to do error correction. Okay, so are there other tricks you can play in dealing with errors and so forth? And this is probably, I'm going to talk quite a bit about that. But then I'll go and try to look for some application in machine learning. And then there's also a lesson to be learned. And that lesson is probably, yeah, you have to be careful when you do that, that you don't do something that's immediately, easily, classically doable. That's sort of the main lesson that you want to take away from those two things. Okay, so why errors? So I guess everybody here knows, yes, decoherence noise is a big problem. Already realized at the very beginning of quantum computing, there's only a finite time when you couple to an environment that you can compute, right? And anything what a quantum algorithm is supposed to do is supposed to outscale everything you can do classically. So how does that work if you only get to compute in a finite window, where that window is determined, well, by your bath, by how you couple, by your physics, essentially, okay? And that was, of course, fixed by introducing quantum error correction. We also know all that, and so that was awesome and great. And in principle, that allows you to compute indefinitely and fix all your errors and whatever. But if you run the numbers, so these are very, by now, a bit old numbers, but they're still good because they're really pessimistic. So, and if you look at that, basically, you see, well, suppose you want to run a Shor's factoring algorithm on a superconducting qubit device with the surface code. So something with a bunch of numbers which are very ambitious in terms of gate fidelity, coherence times, and whatnot, but not completely unrealistic. Okay, and you say, well, okay, if I want to factor a 1,000-bit number, that's something I probably can't do classically. But how long would that take me on a quantum computer? And you see, well, it's only 10 hours. Awesome. Okay, the problem there is, though, you need in the order of 4 × 10⁷ qubits, or 5 × 10⁷ qubits, so you're looking at 50 million qubits to do that. Okay, so that's a bit of a downer. And we're very far away from that, having 50 million qubits. So, I mean, but what is it that you learn from that plot? Yes, there has to be more experimental effort, and there has to be progress in building those. What you also learn is that there has to be more research into quantum error correction. Right, so this is one code which works well because people like the properties that is on a surface that has nice distance scaling and so forth. But there are other problems with that code in terms of not, well, all codes have that, in terms of not having a universal gate set and so forth. So there has to be definitely some more effort into finding more practically relevant codes. That's probably the main message that should be taken away from that. And the next thing is, yes, if you just want to plow ahead and try to do what you're planning to do, then you're going to run into some problems in that sense. But at the same time, our experimental friends have been making very, very steady progress. over the last decade or so. So what is shown here is a plot of the coherence time, so T2 times, so dephasing times, effectively, in your device. And what you can see is basically, oh, well, you basically have a factor of 10 improvement every couple of years. So you have an exponential growth in length in the coherence times. And if you now would pair that with the assumption that, well, also the devices have to grow, which is something that is, to some extent, oh, OK, smaller devices, it's easier to get good coherence times. But then you start building up the devices, you lose again, and so forth. But projecting that that basically continues, you're probably going to, in a couple of years, reach a territory where someone is going to sit down a device, let it be some architecture made out of a bunch of qubits, which are allow for a circuit depth that you can run that you cannot compute simulate classically anymore, right? So that trend follows. So now the natural question is then, okay, you're not going to be able to do fully fault-tolerant quantum computing because you have to do most of the time you have to do error correction, and then your somewhat largest device becomes really small again, and you don't get anything from that. But could you start doing something meaningful with those devices already? So that's the hope. Even though you don't do full actual error correction, but maybe there's some other tricks you can play. Okay? Yes. If you're being a pessimist, then you might interpret that into that. But that last data point, but it's not true. So we have right now, there's one qubit, which is now a single qubit device, in all fairness, which has 500 microseconds at the moment. So it continues. And people don't see a reason why it should stop at the moment. OK, so there's one that has now 500 microsecond T2. And yeah. And this is very specific to only, yes, not flux qubit, transmon qubits, but superconducting qubits, yes. I'm sort of biased there. Okay. That said, so enter NISQ. So this question is exactly, well, you have those devices. What is it that you want to do with them? And you realize, well, what your goal is and what you're looking at is, so it has to be somewhat near-termish. So you don't want to do error correction. Then the next thing is, well, how many qubits do you expect to have? Like 100, a couple of hundreds, maybe in that window. Possibly a bit less than 1,000 in that window, maybe. I don't know. And what you realize is, okay, all those problems are not going to go away. They're still there. Although the numbers are getting better, you still have decoherence, you have gate errors, you have measurement errors. And so forth. All that is going to limit the usefulness. And so what you have to ask yourself is, so what would an algorithm look like that you can run in such a device? Okay, even though it's noisy and whatever. And so the very simplest thing that you can do is essentially the following. So suppose you know that I'm coherence limited. So I'm limited in my coherence time. I'll go, say, 50% to my allowed coherence time. And I'm trying to squeeze the best circuit in there that I might want to do. And I'm going to stop there. So and I hope that the problem, whatever I want to do, sort of fits within that window of the coherence time. So you really go back to the original Unruh complaint, where you say, well, you can only go to this point. Then the question is, can you do something meaningful with that device already? So the setup you're looking at is basically, okay, you run something, and then you measure something, meaning you run that circuit, you sample various outputs, you compute the expectation value from those samples. And your computation should essentially report that expectation value in the end. Okay, so that's your setup. And you ask yourself, well, is there anything that looks like an algorithm that I could squeeze in there? Right? So these are the confines. These are the limits. Is there something you could try to do? And there's something that fits perfectly in that image. Maybe you have heard about those. These are variational quantum eigensolvers. So what is the idea, and why would you want to do that? Well, the idea is essentially you do the same thing as you've done for any physics simulations over decades. You guess a good trial function, and then you evaluate its energy. Okay? So that's the entire idea behind there. So in this case, how do you guess the trial function? Well, the nice thing might be that you generate a trial function that comes from some variational circuit. And then the next thing is that if your Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms, you can basically start measuring this by sampling those outputs and computing and estimating averages. And then you do everything you've done before. So the hope is, why would that be useful? Well, maybe you can construct a trial wave function that is not immediately accessible to someone that does a classical simulation. Maybe that trial wave function has a sign problem. Maybe that trial wave function is so entangled and correlated that that's going to be very hard to simulate it by other means, okay? And it's going to be hard to estimate expectation values on that. And given that, there might be some value to that device of running short depth circuits. And so you vary over all those possible circuits that you could do. And a couple of years ago, we did that in an experiment. We tried that. So the idea was proposed. We should go back. The idea was proposed by Peruzzo and McLean and sorry? Yeah, it's kind of similar because it's a trial. You can, if you view it in the Schrodinger picture, it's essentially, and you want to vary these parameters, and you try to minimize the expectation value, which we learned you might not want to do. Then it fits the same scheme, so this is why I put that up there as well. So this is basically, so Peruzzo et al., Peruzzo and McLean, they called that VQE. Fari called the similar ansatz basically QAOA. Okay. They're similar, but because it's an approximate algorithm, right? The other one, yes. So, but what we want to do is, okay, VQE in the original sense, like you run this and you do some tiny toy problem in chemistry, and then we did that for mapped like a H2 model to 2 qubits, lithium hydride to 4 qubits, beryllium hydride to 6 qubits. So these are tiny models that you can, of course, all solve classically. And you can see what the actual solution should be of the energy curve, like for your energy potential when you start separating them. That should be that dashed line at the bottom, right? So this is what should come out. And you know, if you naively do this VQE ansatz, and we tweak it as best we can, we get, on those noisy devices, we get these black dots, which are pretty abysmal, if you think about it. I mean, they're really far away from what the actual thing should be, and this is 6 qubits. But we also kind of know why they're so bad. Right? So because if you look at that shaded region, that's sort of fit-free numerics. So then the experimentalists went out, measured all the individual qubits, okay, then reported T1, T2 times, and you make a simple amplitude sampling noise model, and then you simulate what actually the chip should be doing in the entire thing, you exactly recover that shaded region. So it's kind of consistent. So people know that in the superconducting qubits community that, well, yeah, the numerical models, they actually fit well to what you do, right? And so you can basically say, well, this is probably mostly all due to decoherence, right? And so we tried, we set out, we went only to 50% of our T1, T2 times, we ran those circuits, and yes, you see decoherence. And so how do you deal with that? Major problem, is something you can do, basically? And so we made a proposal also a couple of years back that where we said, well, okay, we tried something that's called error mitigation, which I'm going to introduce briefly. And we recently, well, that was last year, actually, but we recently published an experiment that actually does that. So you can actually compare those two graphs when you apply this and don't apply that. So why is that so why are those results so bad? So initially, like the story that I told you, you do this short depth circuit and then you measure something after that, would lead you to believe that, well, whatever this quantity is, it's going to have meaning later. At the beginning, everything is just peachy, and it's going to stay peachy until you hit the coherence time, and after that, it's just really bad. Right? This is, of course, not how it works. It looks more like that. And what you're going to see is that, well, if you just go in a tiny bit, you're already pretty bad. Okay? So if you think about that, so how do you fix that? Well, you do error correction. That would be a way of fixing this, but we're not allowed to do that. So is there something else we can do? So what if you just accept the fact that you're not going to go beyond this coherence time, but you try to fix it up somehow differently for these expectation values? So maybe you can get your device to show a behavior a bit like that, right? So where within that window, yes, you get a decent approximation, and outside you accept that you're really wrong, okay? Is there some way to go about this? And so this is what we essentially proposed in that error mitigation paper. And so we thought about two methods of exactly achieving that behavior. Okay, so one was we dubbed zero noise extrapolation, where we actually already did those experiments. So this is what I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to talk about this one, but just a brief comment is how that works is basically there's a way of resampling your circuits with a quasi-probability distribution and then averaging over that many families of circuits to essentially achieve a similar effect as I'll be discussing now. But so let me talk about that the first method, mostly zero noise extrapolation, because I have experimental data for that one. Okay, so let's talk about what the idea is here. So if you think about that, it's okay, this is our circuit, and we're going to run that. So you can treat that as a circuit now, but simple, very trivial observation. Well, what actually happens, this is a dynamical system. Depends on time, it's continuous on time, and it evolves with the time-dependent Hamiltonian. Just rephrasing that. Okay, and what you realize that, okay, the circuit you do in the end is just the time-order integral, fine. So what you want to do then is basically, well, your actual dynamics would be just evolved with that, but what happens in practice is you have noise here, okay? And the cool thing about the first method is I don't need to know what that noise is, okay? I only need to know one thing, and it has to be there all the time, constant in time. So there's nothing I can do about that noise. It's basically, you can imagine, you're the system, you're coupling to some environment. It doesn't even need to be a Markovian noise. It can also be coherent constant noise, or it can be just general, in that by that also non-Markovian noise coupling to the environment. The only thing I want to know, or need to know, is that this is just constant in time. It's always there. There's nothing I can do about this, right? So if you do that, then the trick is basically, okay, how about if I look at the expectation value that I measure after time t, and treat that as a function of that dummy noise parameter, which I don't need to know that value either. But so it's, lambda by itself is not a meaningful value, supposed to just indicate it's small, right? But lambda times L, that's a meaningful physical quantity. But what if I go and treat this as a function of this lambda? Can I do something with that? And yes, so there's a trick that people have used over 1.5 centuries ago, I think, over a century ago. And this is called Richardson extrapolation. Okay, it's a numerical trick that people have been using frequently. It's a serious acceleration method. And what you do is basically, so suppose you're granted that your function has sort of this form. So there's an analytic expansion away from zero in that noise parameter. And you can see it does, because of the rules of quantum mechanics, you just write down what the actual perturbed evolution is, and you end up having that expansion. Okay? What you want to do now in this Richardson extrapolation is you want to get rid of those terms order by order. Okay? So and the question is, okay, then that way, this is the ideal noise-free expectation value. Initially, you wear something that was linear in that order, in that noise parameter, and you just want to cancel that order by order, getting better and better approximations to that. So how would you go about doing that? And well, what you would do is essentially, if you wanted to just do just Richardson extrapolation, well, you try to measure that function at different noise rates. Suppose the experimentalist had a knob where he said, well, now I'm going to make my noise exactly 2 times as bad, 4 times as bad, 6 times as bad, and so forth. And you have those knobs, and you try to recombine them. Then you just solve that system of linear equations, recombine these estimated values, and you can see that all these terms essentially cancel due to that property. You end up with an approximation that is better, right? Exponentially better in that sense. If you have n points, you have exponentially n plus first order error. There's a limit to this in Richardson extrapolation. So what this O hides is there's a prefactor in gamma. And so if those points are chosen poorly, and so forth, that prefactor basically blows up. And there's also a limit in terms of how long you can go. I'm going to show the error bound in a second, the right one. Okay. So now the problem is then if you go to an experimentalist and tell them, well, just run that at different noise rates, they're going to tell you to bugger off, because they have no control about that. And so is there a different way you could deal with that? So in that setting, so how do you measure that? Is, well, what you actually do originally is you have these noisy dynamics, and you evolve with that Hamiltonian that looks like that in a bunch of microwave pulses that you send into the chip. What you could do is the following. You just stretch out those microwave pulses. Okay, you go slower. You stretch out in each individual pulse. You decrease it in the magnitude, and you evolve this entire thing for a time c times t. Okay, so then if this was just everything, so k and c, you just evolve coherently, and this term wasn't there, you'd end up with exactly the same unitary formally, right? But if you then reparametrize that stretched out of equation in a scaled time frame, you realize you're going to pick up a prefactor of c there, which is exactly the prefactor that we want to amplify the noise. So the trick is basically to amplify that noise, you don't tweak around the experimental setup, you just run slower under the assumption that this is constant in time. Okay? We can argue, well, is that true? Is that not true? We'll see. So if you do that, then you just get the standard error bound from Richardson extrapolation. What you're going to see is, okay, so there's actually this evolution time that crops up here, so there's a time limit on how far you can go. This thing here is also basically, if it's local noise, it's going to scale as number of qubits to the order. So this parameter you want, if you combine those, you want the number of qubits times the time you go times lambda, where lambda should be a physically meaningful quantity now. Just you want that to be small. And then you can start playing that game of error mitigation. So, right? So this is basically an estimate for this quantity if you have a if you have your local noise term. It's still there. So it's I only focused on lambda, but this is the same thing. So this is the correct expression. So it's lambda times t times n plus 1. That's the correct expression. If you want to look at only the small parameter, I just, for simplicity, for the sake of this talk, I suppress the t, okay? But it's there. So it gives you a time limit of how far you can go, right? Okay, so, and then if you do some tiny numerics for like 4-6 qubit without statistical noise, it looks really peachy. So they're sitting here at the, at roughly this part. And so if you were to go to like fourth order extrapolation, where you don't encounter really hard extrapolation problems, you're gonna see is, oh, you're down to 10 to the minus 8. So if you think about that, the number of samples that they have to draw to estimate each expectation value scales quadratically in their precision. So they would have to draw already 10 to the 16 samples in order to get there, so which is a lot. So you, that sets the limit, say, okay? So you probably don't want to go further. Okay, so you have now a method. How well does that work in practice? So these are the experiments that we actually did. So this is the first experiment that we ran was, okay, this is single qubit, everything easy and doable. And now we do a single qubit randomized Clifford sequence. So what you do is you basically go, you randomly generate a bunch of Cliffords, compute their product, compute their inverse, multiply that as a last gate. And essentially what you should have implemented is the identity gate. So nothing should have changed if you started roughly at 1. So we didn't correct for the readout error, so this is why it's not 1. But so this is basically, you see that decay. Okay, after if you go in the number of flippers for a single thing. So if you do that and you slow down the gates, you get worse. And then you can go and recombine them and get better. This is first order. Okay, so you have this cartoonish behavior that I mentioned beforehand. You can do that to second order, third order. Okay, so that means you have to run this experiment 4 times. And then you end up with that curve, roughly. And so you say, well, you're kind of good. Modulo statistic fluctuations and all that other stuff, up to, say, 150 Cliffords, single qubit Cliffords, right? So but then you clearly shouldn't continue. Right, so there's a nicer picture that you can look at. It's basically, okay, so what if you do like a, you want to simulate a trajectory around your Bloch sphere, also single qubit thing, so all kinds of things are involved. And ideally, the way that was set up and parametrized in the experiment is they should just walk around these points until you reach from 1 to 0, basically. And what happens is, well, it decoheres. That's what red does. And then if you go slower, the green curve decoheres more. But if you then extrapolate, you get something that looks a lot closer to what you expect you should be getting. So it moves closer to the surface of the thing. You can play the same game. This is first order for two-qubit gates. So if you have single-qubit gates and two-qubit gates that you can stretch, you can actually try to fix these experiments that we were doing initially in the chemistry, right? So in the first experiment, this is the curve that we initially had, where those points came from. The old data. So and if you now basically even allow us a bit more depth, because now we can actually error mitigate and go a bit longer before it becomes really bad, then you get an experiment. We had to slow down the gates to be really clear that we actually rescale everything the right way, and so there's a couple of tricks. So it actually becomes worse than we did initially from the actual experimental data. But if you use those, you need 2-bit data points to do first-order extrapolation. So you take the orange one and the green one, and you extrapolate, you do this. So you end up on that curve, okay? 2 qubits, well, fine. But if you do that for the 4-qubit experiment, you really see a lot more of the difference. So this is the original noisy curve. So this is first order. So important to point out, this of course doesn't fix all your problems that you have, right? Because so there's coherent gate errors that you might not be able to fix. There's sampling errors that you might not be able to fix. There's readout errors that this doesn't fix. But this decoherence part, that sort of gets fixed within within reason, within tight confines of what you want to do. Okay, so the thing about all those chemistry experiments is you don't really see much because those tiny molecules, like these tiny models of molecules, it's just 4-6 qubits, you typically just guess a product state and that one does reasonably better than what you can do with noise, right? Where it's a bit nicer, say, let's look at a very trivial spin system of 4 qubits. Just look at a Heisenberg at 4 qubits. And what you see is basically, in principle, there's this depth, like the time. You can think of this as basically how deep do you go into that circuit, basically, or how long do you evolve that circuit for. And for that particular ansatz that we had, you said, well, you actually would reach the ground state after 8 steps, okay? But what you see is that after 2 steps, where you start improving, basically in your guest travel wave function, after 2 steps you get worse. You get actually so much worse that it's worse than whatever you guessed as a product, what your best product state guess would be, right? So okay, is that useful? Well, if you recombine those and basically you see all these stretched evolutions, they also get worse. Fine, but the interesting part is, although this is worse than what you could do classically, you can still extrapolate from that because you know its behavior, and you get this curve, which actually goes down in energy as you increase the depth. Only to a certain point, because again, there's limits to all this, and given the parameters of the devices, then after a while, it just starts getting worse again, right? But okay, so that means, so what you can try to do is you can try to fix expectation values of very short circuits using this extrapolation trick. Okay, now the next question is, okay, is there something else you can do? And since this is a machine learning conference, I'll talk about a paper that we had in that direction. So there's been a couple of ideas to say, well, let's use those NIST devices with their confinement and what you can do in terms of trying to come up with sort of near-term applications. So I'm gonna be talking about that paper, but I also like to point out Maria Scholl's paper, who basically had the same idea at the time. Right, and so there's two methods. You can just try to use your device to estimate kernels, or you can come up with very fancy variational circuits to do the same, to do something similar. Okay. So what I'm trying to do right now is basically what we're trying to do here is basically, okay, let's think about the simplest possible thing in machine learning you could do, which is just construct a binary classifier. Okay, this is basically the setup, and what you could try to do is you follow, since variational circuits are all in our minds, we could try to do that, okay? So you just think about that setup where you say, well, here's a very naive attempt. What you could do is basically, oh yeah, you just start out preparing your data, you load that, we've seen that earlier. Next step is you have a variational circuit that does something, you measure some Boolean function at the output, and then you threshold, as we heard earlier, okay? So, one instantiation here, right? So what you could do is basically, okay, let's just map the data as a bunch of single qubit rotations. Okay, so you have 5 qubits available, so let's look at 5 rotation angles, and so there's R5 that you're trying to map to a larger feature space, and then let's think about a really fancy, really complicated, perfectly tuned variational circuit here. Okay, and then we do the same thing, we measure, define some +1, -1, look at the Hilbert, at the histogram, and then threshold. Okay, bear with me, I know you all know this, but one second, okay? So what is a classical support vector machine? Well, if you have 2 clouds, you wanna draw a linear threshold between them, and there's many you can draw, and for purposes of generalization error, you wanna draw the one that has the largest margin between those 2 clouds. And then when you classify, you just basically ask, well, am I to the left or am I to the right of that cloud? So it's just that sine function, okay? Everybody knows that. So what do we do if you don't take the data apart so easily? Well, you map to a really high-dimensional feature space. And so you take a nonlinear map, you go and map it to a larger feature space. And your concern could be, well, if that's a really large space, how do I deal with that? Well, you can don't need to, because it's a convex problem, the primal, let's look at the dual, which also is a concave problem now. But now this dual optimization problem is only as large as the variables you optimize over is only as large as the training size. So it's quadratically difficult, but then it only depends. So we have this quadratic optimization problem, and the only point where this feature space enters is essentially through that kernel matrix, the kernel method. Everybody knows essentially an inner product between those feature vectors in this very high dimensional space. Okay, why did I mention that? That's very trivial observation. Let's try to go back what the first circuit does. Okay, so we said, okay, yeah, you assign y if this thing is larger than the other one. So one histogram with label y is larger than the one with the minus one, given some bias. So, and if you take Ackermann number 5 samples, then you get pretty close to the ideal measure, right? And that looks like this. So it's basically 1/2 plus y times the expectation value. And if you then go, you're like, okay, well, actually, the decision function is the threshold function of this expectation value plus b, okay? Fine. This is all that the circuit does, and you vary these w's, okay? But if you just immediately look at this, you basically, well, actually what this observable is, it takes the role as a normal, right? And what this state does that we had, if you write it like this, it actually just acts like a feature vector, okay? So what you do is you just do, well, all that you did before with this variational circuit is you just implemented an SVM, as you have done before, right? And so if you think about that, okay, fine, but it might be an SVM in a really high dimensional space, and that might be very good. And the answer is, well, not if you can compute the kernel. Because then you'd rather go and compute the kernel classically. Because so if you look at these initial product states that you had, you can take basically the product between these individual two qubits things, and you can compute the kernel in linear time. So that said, what we set out to do with this really fancy variational circuit is essentially better done if I just use a classical standard SVM, compute a bunch of inner product states, and declare that to be the kernel. Okay, so then the question is, so how do you fix that? Or so what is the chance that you, if you want to do something like that, that you gain some value from whatever it is that you're doing? And then the simple answer is, well, just take care that you're not able to compute that that inner product of the kernel anymore. So that's step one. Okay, let's talk about that. Okay, so the idea is then, okay, so the interesting part is not the variational circuit that you're setting up there. The interesting part is how you choose to map your data. So that's sort of the interesting question, that entire thing. And so it's going to be some nonlinear map, so you want to make sure that the data doesn't, like, whatever you map, like, the map is, depends nonlinear on your data, and it maps you to some to quantum state space, okay? So since product states are not good, let's try something simple first. Oh, shoot. Okay. Okay, first round. So you say, okay, yeah, you need something entangling. So what you do is you do a Fourier transform. You basically do something diagonal. And then if you look at the kernel, you basically have Fourier transform, diagonal Fourier transform. And that looks like an IQP circuit. Awesome. So typically, IQP circuits come with some hardness result. But the crux here is basically you only care about one amplitude. Nice, because that one amplitude could potentially encode a Sharpe hard quantity. But you only get to sample it to additive error. Okay, that means I can sample that kernel with H, diagonal H, up to additive error classically by just doing uniform sampling and averaging up the phases. Then I get also an additive error in the same amount of samples. So we do the next stupid thing. Well, I'll just repeat that. Okay, so we do that, diagonal, maybe that gives you something meaningful. And so there's actually a circuit that looks kind of similar to that, which is related to the hidden shift problem. And so might be that might be hard. Okay, let me run, because I'm like 4 minutes, sorry. 5 minutes. So there's two ways you can do this now. Yeah, well, you can run your variational circuits if you like, or you can just estimate the kernel directly. So if your kernel is given in terms of such a short depth circuit, then you essentially apply some unitary initially that depends on x, and then it's inverse there, and you just count how many times you see zero, and that's your kernel entry. Okay? Then you do your standard SVM and so forth. So why could you believe that this might be difficult to do for a classical computer just to estimate that kernel entry? Well, that problem happens to be related to something called threefold correlation, right? And so if you believe, so this isn't, that problem basically has an oracle separation in query complexity between what you, to estimate exactly the kernel entry, if you want to read it that way, to what you've done beforehand. That's what I meant. Sorry. And we can't claim that this clearly is hard classically, because we choose a concrete instantiation of the oracle. So it might be that for that oracle, essentially stuff becomes easily classical. But nonetheless, the main point is, well, there might be circuits that are hard, which have hard to estimate transition amplitudes. So that might be a place where you could look for some meaningful quantum advantage. We're not claiming that this is necessarily a meaningful feature map. It might very much not be, But just so you know, okay, there are circuits like that. So then if you wanted the interesting part, then to the experimentalist is, okay, fine, now you design something that's really short depth, and you estimate that, let's try that out. Let's try that out in a very tiny experiment, because already in tiny experiments, you see where things go wrong. And since we just pulled that feature map out of nowhere, let's generate data that is gapped, that is perfectly, that we know in theory has to be has a margin, that we don't just know where it is, but in that feature space, it's separable with a margin. Okay, so we generate that data artificially, so we cheat, and that's what it looks like. And then your question is, well, are they able to recover that in the actual experiment? So if I don't tell them what that hyperplane is, in that well, it's operator space, so it's 15-dimensional real space, right? If they don't know what it is, can they find that? Right. So that's the task. So and so the experimentalists went off and did that, and so this is essentially the kernel matrix, what it should look like, okay? Even for 2 qubits. So these are all these entries between 40 data points, so 20 plus labels, 20 minus labels, and if they run it as good as best they can, they end up with something like that. It's only for 2 qubits, and you immediately see, well, they don't look very similar. I actually don't have the success probability of that thing. Maybe I should put that, but it was sort of somewhere around the 67-ish. So it did pretty poorly. But if you stretch, because all these entries are expectation values that you estimate, you can essentially do the same error mitigation trick. That's sort of the point, right? You do estimate one kernel as best you can, then you stretch it down, and you recombine, okay? And the recombined one is actually pretty close to the true one that is non-noisy. Okay, and so that's the line where it strongest deviates, and I think it's this example that per entry-wise basically deviates the most. Now, if you do that, you basically, well, because you constructed it that way, you always classify correctly, right? Because there is a margin, all the new samples that you draw respect that margin, so all the samples that you use for testing basically get classified correctly in that noisy setting after you've done mitigation. And this is basically the curve that you would get using the same feature map, also mitigation, doing that variational method. So I think I'm out of time. Good. So what are the two points that we have? So if you think about that, yes, errors matter a lot, and decoherence matters a lot. So you have to really worry about that and think about ways in your experiment or in your tiny circuit design of how you could deal with that. And the other thing is basically I think the main message that you want to take away from that is exactly that. If you look at these variational circuits for those machine learning things, then at least you have to make sure that you come up with a circuit that gives rise to a feature map or a kernel for which you cannot estimate the entries classically. So that progress was really, really interesting to see it that way, right? And so that's basically the, the main message to take away. Okay, thanks. Do you have questions?
Thank you, Christoph. We have some time for questions.
Yeah, so sorry, just this is really a question, basic question. So when you're doing when you're recombining, right?
I'm sorry, say again?
When you have the curve, the stretch curve, so you measure, and then you have to do the recombination. I missed how you perform this recombination.
Okay, so, sorry, I can go back. So it's
really
essentially,
missed it, so.
Right. So, sorry, oops, that's the other method. Sorry, wrong direction. Right, that happens here. So what you try to do is you solve, so this is just standard Richardson extrapolation, so that what Richardson came up with 100 years ago. So if you have these different values, you can basically see, you know what these stretch coefficients are, then you can look at this system of linear equations, right? So you try to determine these gammas. And these gammas have the properties that they sum to one, but their sum over all cj to the k, they all go to zero. Okay, so if you now plug these values into that analytic expansion here, and you look at this linear combination, then you can basically change the order of sums, and all these terms drop out because of this condition, and the only one that remains is this one and the remainder. That's why you look at these multiple things.
Okay, so but you get both the energy and the state.
No, this is the thing. You only the state is wrong.
Because if you're doing an eigensolve, you want so.
No, no, you get all the expectation values corrected for that.
Oh, okay. You
get so it doesn't have to be necessarily only the Hamiltonian. But suppose you prepare a state that is really bad.
Yes.
That's decohered, and then you want to go and measure some correlation function.
Okay.
Right. So you go, you measure the correlation function on the very bad state.
Okay.
And then you could then okay, that's of course bad because the state is bad. But then you can play the same game as you would for the energy.
Okay.
Okay. You just recombine them and then.
Okay.
Perfect. Okay.
Yes.
But it doesn't fix the state. So
okay.
So it's
okay.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Okay. We have time for one more question.
In your extrapolation scheme, you did not ever use any information about these Lindblad operators, whatever their form is. Wouldn't knowing more about them help in the sense that if you knew more about the structure of the participation, and also didn't you make some assumption on them that they, when you did stretching, that nothing changed in their form?
Yes. So this is the
can that be checked in some? If I knew microscopically how dissipation was, decoherence was occurring,
right?
Has that been checked in some physical model, and that can be tested?
Okay, there's a couple of answers. So, in general, I don't know whether exactly knowing the noise model helps, but there's one case where it, for instance, would help. So suppose you know that in your noise model, so that only the even terms here appear. That would be awesome because then you only extrapolate even powers. You immediately get an improvement by only going for all the. So if you knew that was the case, then that would be very helpful. Yes, that's number one. Number two, you're right. That is the major assumption, is that if it's not necessarily Lindbladian. It can also be Nomarkovian. It doesn't have to be Lindbladian. But yes, the assumption is if you start fiddling around with your gates, that doesn't change the noise. So a lot of ion trap people don't really like it that much because of that reason, because their dominant error is basically when they do that Malmes-Sorensen gate or whatever gate. And so it's mostly that they get decoherence from not doing the gate right? Because they walk in a larger space. So they don't they have to think of other ways of amplifying the noise if you want to do that, right? But for the superconducting things, this is really exactly what the dominant source of noise is, that you couple to the environment, and it's always there, which is not quite true because it fluctuates in time. So depending on how your bath changes, that changes as well. But there's a way around this by arranging the measurements in the right way and so forth, that they can fix it. But yes, this is a big assumption. So how do you check that? Well, there's a couple things you check. One thing you essentially check is you go and look at whether you stretch right. That's one thing you have to check. The next thing you have to check is basically if you can play around with Richardson extrapolation, you get all the other coefficients as well. And so you can basically see whether canceling them tells you that this behaves the right way, right? But exactly.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thanks.